Hey guys, how's it going? Ricky from Da Vinci. Welcome to the At Odds podcast. Today we're talking about something that happened about a week ago that I've been thinking a lot about. That was the power outages in Spain and Portugal that people have been talking about. Now, there's a lot of misconceptions, actual realities, and a lot more. But I think this showcases something important enough that we should talk about it. And so in this episode, we're going to do that. We're going to talk about it and stay tuned to the end where we can interact with our comments and we can have some fun and just chat about updates and stuff. But we'll start with the show. All right. So first and foremost, on April 28th, 2025, a massive blackout plunged Spain and Portugal into darkness. The event exposed hidden vulnerabilities in our grid that could get worse in the future. That's why this is important. So in this video, we wanted to talk about what exactly happened, how some of the things that are happening around the world, especially as we transition to a more sustainable grid, has played a role, and what we need to do moving forward. All right. So that's why we're here today. So around noon, two major generation units in Spain abruptly disconnected, again on April 28th, from the grid. Within 5 seconds, the country lost 15 gigawatts of capacity, about 60% of its total supply. The blackout spread rapidly, and it even affected neighboring Portugal and even parts of France. Because remember, all these grids are interconnected. Spain doesn't live on an island. There's interconnects to France. And when some of these weird fluctuations in voltage or frequency happen, the only response is to shut it down. Because otherwise, this could have affected France and beyond. But those were significant disconnects. Now, the first grid disconnect was actually recovered. They were actually able to keep the grid up from that one. But then there was a massive disconnect that caused power outages. And by midnight, the power did come back. But this is one of the most significant power outages in Europe in the last few decades. So this was a big deal. Now, the cost, obviously, there's economic cost and stuff. But surprisingly, 7 people passed away, many due to fires or generator-related accidents. People trying to fire up generators not doing so correctly. Maybe they weren't well-serviced. In Portugal, a woman even passed away from being dependent on a ventilator. So this is all to say that our world is incredibly dependent upon electricity to work, right? You can imagine metros and train stations in major cities were shut down, airport runways were, you know, airport operations were caused, massive delays resulted, and they were all running on emergency power. This is really terrifying because you can imagine Spain, air traffic control would have been impacted by this as well. Internet and mobile networks didn't work. So imagine if in the midst of all the chaos, you can't even pick up your phone and make a phone call. That kind of stuff really does add to the whole thing. So when these kinds of things happen, we kind of resort back to the old ways. So some areas were using like FM and AM radio as a means of getting messages around, right? Businesses closed, schools were shuttered during these periods. And to the point about how important electricity is, how about water? Sure, we have water pumps, which use potential energy from gravity to force head pressure and to get to your faucet. But a lot of cities, a lot of municipalities also have water pumps that are electric that need the grid to operate. Now, hospitals or schools might have backup power, but it's a case-by-case basis, right? So you can imagine even then, if your generator hasn't been fired up in a while, it might not work when you need it if you haven't maintained it properly. It's one of the drawbacks of fossil fuel-powered generators. And of course, the prices and all this fluctuations and uncertainty cause prices to soar. Now, that's not actually that uncommon. This happens all during the day. We don't notice it because our utility provider kind of ships us an average price. But it's like a stock market. The prices for electricity vary all during the day. So this was a big deal. Now, really quickly, I wanted to talk a little bit about black starts, which is when the grid goes down, how do you get it back up, which is a surprisingly difficult thing to do. Okay. We don't think about this because the grid just kind of works, which is another shocking reality in our modern world. If you think about the grid and what it has to do, it's almost unbelievable that it actually works. And this is what I mean. So if you imagine this is like the demand, right? It goes up and it comes down, and depending on the time frame, it might be very tough to predict. And then what the grid has to do is in real time match that. It just try to fit exactly, you know, the time of day, cloudiness, conditions, changes in production, and try to match this. And if they're able to do that, they can keep the voltage and frequency in sync and everyone's happy. Now, you can imagine how hard this actually is to do. So if the power were to go out, here is a scenario, and this is actually based on an actual event that happened. Here's how you would get the grid back online. One, a battery starts a small diesel generator installed in a hydroelectric generating station. The power from the diesel generator is used to bring the generation station back online. So first we have a battery to start a generator, because remember, if you have an internal combustion engine car, you have an electric starter motor that has to start the piston operation to get the fuel going. You can't just start it by itself. Same goes for airplanes and everything else. From there, then you start to bring the power plant online. And remember, these large turbines have to spin up, these generators, these dynamos, and they have their own inertia. They have to start to build up steam and start to regulate and fluctuate. And then eventually, they reach a nice steady state level. In the U.S., we have a 60 hertz frequency grid. In Europe, it's 50. Around the world, it depends. But that frequency is how many times that AC wave goes up and down in 1 second. So in the U.S., 60 times a second. And that's really critical, because if that starts to get out of whack, it could cause brownouts and cause damage to your devices and so much more. So then key transmission lines between these stations and the areas have to be energized. So all the while this power plant is coming online, it has to be disconnected, because that large generator, as it's spinning up, the frequency is not going to be what you want. So it has to find a way to come up to speed and then connect to larger parts of the grid. And they have to do this in this incredible harmony. It's like an orchestrated dance where every one of these pieces have to come on at the same time, slowly over time, not the same time, but in a set order to be able to maintain that grid and bring it back up. It is a large challenge, obviously something that we can do, but it is tough. Now, the power from these stations are used to start nuclear fossil fuel-based baseload power plants. So like this could be like a coal station or natural gas, a nuclear power plant, which needs its own set of requirements to be met before it can be turned on. So there's like this domino cascading effect of things that have to happen. Finally, the baseload power plant is used to restart all the other power plants in the system, and then power is finally reapplied to the general electricity distribution network and actually sent to customers. That's what they had to do to get this all back eventually. And they did, obviously. But I just want to kind of make it clear how difficult that actually is to do. It's a really tough problem to solve, believe it or not. Okay. Now, if you've been watching the news, you know, I've been doing this long enough to know that people are always looking for something to blame, right? And it's really easy to blame renewable energy, electric vehicles, things like this. We've seen it here over time. But I want to show you something. This is a graph of Spain's electricity that comes from renewable sources. Back in 2008, it's only about 20%, which is actually still amazing. But look what's happened. By 2024, that number is 57%. Now, I remember this because I follow a couple of accounts on Twitter and that show how much power is being produced by pure clean energy sources. And Spain, many times during the days, have gone like 24 hours straight purely on like renewable sunshine, wind, and it's an amazing accomplishment. But there is something that the detractors have been saying that has a level of truth to it, which is when you produce electricity from wind and solar, something does change. Now, one thing that all the fossil fuel and nuclear power plants have are large generators. These are large wheels. Imagine like a big bicycle wheel that you have to spin up. Now, these blades and these turbines have a lot of bulk, and so they have angular momentum that you have to build up. The good thing about that is, let's say, you know, there's a huge demand increase, people start, you know, turning on their air conditioners or something, that will actually put a strain on the generator and these things. But this inertia helps to bring stabilization and stability, because you've got this big, massive flywheel that's spinning up. Think about, here's a way to kind of visualize this. If you had a thin little road bike tire that, you know, carbon fiber and ultra lightweight, and you spin it up and you start putting your hand on it, you can slow it down really easily and you can spin it up really easily. That is not what's at play here. the inertia that these generation stations provide are large, heavy machines that need a lot of energy to spin up. And if you were to put your hand on a big, imagine a big, massive 500-pound wheel that you take, you know, 15 minutes to get up to speed. Well, once you have it up to speed, if you try to put your hand on it to slow it down, it will barely make an impact. That is inertia, which is a good thing because it helps keep the grid like a clock on time. It helps bring stability. It helps to, you know, regulate the speed, which controls frequency, voltage, all the rest. Now, as we're bringing down coal power plants, for example, and in Europe, even certain countries are abandoning nuclear, and we're going to more and more renewables like wind and solar, this changes. Because in a solar PV generation station, there is no large flywheel. There is no inertia. You have solar coming in. You have a, you know, photovoltaic effect that converts the photons of light into electricity, and then it goes and converts into AC and is sent out to the grid. Now, here's, if you've ever noticed, like, have you ever seen your house fall into a quick little instant of shade, like when a plane flies by? Imagine what happens to a solar power plant when that happens, right? If you have something that flies overhead or clouds roll through, you've got wild fluctuations. Now, it's easy to think that this is like what a solar curve looks like, right? We've all seen solar curves that look like this. It comes up, lifts up during the day, and then, you know, dips down at night. But the reality is this is smoothed, meaning how quickly are you sampling? Because if you were to sample every second, it might look like this, right? There might be huge fluctuations. Clouds might come in. And these things are hard for the grid to deal with. But and wind is kind of similar as well. Wind does have a mechanical component, the turbine, that has to spin. So there's a little more stability provided by wind turbines and solar panels. But in either case, there's a truth that there is going to be a challenge from this. Now, was this the reason? We actually don't know exactly what caused the Spanish outage. But as you can see, Spain is killing it in terms of solar generation and renewable sources of clean energy for their grid. And this will be a challenge. Hopefully that kind of makes sense. So what is the solution then? Should we just abandon wind and solar and go back to nuclear and fossil fuels? Well, nuclear is interesting. Sound off in the comments what you how you guys feel about nuclear. I do find that it's pretty contentious, but it is another tool in the toolkit. Obviously, we're not going to go back to coal. Coal is just very expensive, and I think the prices of these other generation stations have just completely changed the economics there. I also wanted to quickly show you, here is a look at some of the different types of things that Spain has invested in. So you can see there's a fair bit of large photovoltaic farms, but they also have heliostats. You know, they have thermoelectric generation stations like the Ivanpah here in California. And you can see these towers that stand tall. These heliostats, these mirrors, shine the light to a central tower. Now these are a little more finicky because there's a lot of moving parts and stuff, but you can just kind of see how much they've invested in solar. And in Spain, a country in Europe that has a lot of sunshine, it makes a ton of sense. So to answer the question of how we deal with this going forward, I want to just kind of quickly use the example of my own house, okay? So we have about 20 kilowatts of solar at this point. We have a video coming out soon how we've added to our system without losing our NEM status, thanks to our battery provider, Franklin. So subscribe and stay tuned. We'll talk about that because we do have two electric vehicles. We have a lot of demand, so we needed a lot of generation. In our house, on cloudy days, it's actually really difficult to get through. So what we have to do is really change our consumer habits. But our solar does the same thing that I showed here in this graph, where it's very up and down, right? But the difference is that my solar never goes directly anywhere. It goes into a battery. And the battery is like the buffer. In the future, when we have more sustainable sources of energy, the inertia, if you will, the inertia, the flywheel, that system that's hard to mess with, that keeps the train on the track, you know, keeps the grid regular, that will have to come from batteries. If you guys remember, I made a video with skeleton supercapacitors about a month ago. where I went to Estonia and met with one of the world's forefront manufacturers of graphene, and they use graphene to make supercapacitors. But interestingly, they showed me their labs and they showed me all the different applications. So supercapacitors are amazing whenever you need instant power for small periods of time, which is exactly what we need here for the grid, right? But ironically, when I was meeting with them, in my mind, I was more excited about race cars, elevators, all these other different use cases that have the same need. Like if you're in a Formula One car and you're going 280 kilometers an hour and you come to a bend and you got to slow down, you're hitting the brakes and having to regenerate that energy. And sometimes that could be higher than what a battery can charge at. It could be higher than the maximum charge rate of a battery. And a supercapacitor is fantastic for that. It can charge and discharge nearly instantly. And so Skeleton makes products exactly for this purpose. So anybody in Spain and Portugal, if you're watching this, you got to reach out to companies like Skeleton or others that have products like this that are made to bring stability to the grid. What they can do is they can take quick voltage spikes or fluctuations and sync that in and out of their battery packs or their supercapacitors to help regulate the grid and give you nice, smooth, predictable outcomes. And even if it's not a supercapacitor with a large enough battery, it can do the same thing. The difference really is that a supercapacitor shines when you just need a couple of seconds, right? If you've got a big event or big fluctuations, a supercapacitor would be the cheapest way to do it because you don't need to have a large installation to just be able to absorb 5 or 6 seconds of activity. Now, long term, the grids around the world, we're going to need batteries because a battery not only gives you a place to store excess sunshine for nighttime when there's no sun or when there's no wind, but it also does the same thing. In our house example, our solar goes into the batteries. And what the battery is always doing is providing whatever is needed to the house, right? Maybe the house is using a little bit of energy, not as much as the solar is producing. So the battery starts to charge. And then as soon as the oven turns on and it has this huge 5 kilowatt spike, the battery kicks in and starts sending it to the house to take care of it. And then it'll start charging from the solar or change that ratio to keep a nice steady flow. The thing is, the demand from the grid has always been variable. It's always been this way. Like you never know how much energy a person is going to use in their home. Maybe they come home and turn on their air conditioning. They have all their friends over. They have a party, whatever it is, right? The kettles in the UK is a famous one. After certain soap operas or TV shows in the prime BBC windows, all the people of London would go and turn on their electric kettles to make tea. And it's these weird, huge spikes of energy. Now, that's always been the case. But when we move to more sustainable forms of energy generation, now it's not just the demand that's variable. Now it's also the generation. And that sounds scary. But again, the answer to this is batteries. It just has to be. It's an impossible thing. Imagine the stress of going, I wonder how the sun is going to shine today in real time and trying to manage the sun shining with the demand. Nearly impossible. And these problems could get worse. They could be exacerbated if we don't take this action. So Europe plans, by the way, to install 50 gigawatt of battery storage by 2030, but they'll probably need, based on expert analysis, probably closer to 200 gigawatts of power output from these battery storage systems. Now, I'm not sure how much energy storage that translates to, but clearly if you want to go, run entirely on renewable energy and start talking about phasing other things down, you'll have to have battery storage as well, not just for power output to regulate, but to power homes in the night and when the wind's not blowing. So I think this is one of those examples where there's some truth to this, right? I mean, the grid's job just got harder. Like, that is true. But think about the benefit of a massive PV wind farm, a solar farm. The sun shines the next day and your fuel source just magically pops up out of the sky and you're on your way. Compared to, if it's natural gas, dealing with contracts with companies, all the instability that's caused from natural gas prices in Europe soaring from the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. Imagine having to deal with a company that you have to buy fuel from and dealing with their contracts and how their prices fluctuate and dealing with that. Because remember, natural gas is burnt instantly. It's just for an instant of value. And you got to keep burning it. Compared to a solar panel that you produce, and you set out in the sun for 30 years plus, that just keeps on making energy. That is the beauty of it. And over in the course of history, we've had these pain points before when we've made transitions. If you went back to the first internal combustion cars, imagine the stories people told, like the car will never work. You know, our roads and stores and shops are made with oats and water for the horses, not for fuel. Where are you going to fuel these things? It'll never work. And then we figured it out. We built a network of refineries and wells. We produced an entire storage system and built gas stations. It's kind of the same thing. We can't think about the grid in the ways that we used to because the way we're making energy is super cool, renewable. It just comes back every day. The wind blows, the sun shines, but we do have to handle this instability. And if I'm honest, this is one of the situations where I'm kind of amazed that we don't have more of these problems, honestly. I'm shocked that the grid operators can handle this and like seemingly perfectly almost all the time. It is a true, true remarkable thing. One of my goals for this year actually is to meet with like a large scale grid operator, power plant, something like that, and go into like the control room. And I want to see like a day in the life of a grid operator because they're truly heroes that do this. And it's incredible that it works. But I think the story here in Europe, in Spain, is a cautionary one of how valuable and amazing and important it is to have a more renewable form of generation, but that there is an Achilles heel to renewables that need to be addressed in lockstep. Some of these stories all blend together, right? I mentioned skeleton supercapacitors that literally make a product you can buy today for this very reason. They have a product you could buy right now, put on the grid, bring it online the next couple of years, and you're good to go. Then, you know, we were actually recently in Shanghai. We met with CATL on this breakthrough sodium ion battery and a couple of other breakthroughs that they made. But imagine what sodium ion batteries would do for the grid. Sodium is 1,000 times more abundant than lithium. And while they're not quite as energy dense, if the prices were a fraction of what it is for a lithium ion battery and they're mass produced, in 5 or 6 years, we might live in a world where batteries are not even they're an afterthought. You just buy them and stick them everywhere. And we have huge amounts of battery installations all around the world. And this would be a non-factor. But this does give me a little bit of a reminder of why we pick the topics that we do. It can be seemingly kind of random and crazy, but there's a overarching storyline to all these topics. And I think it's a fascinating one. Hopefully, U-Haul says Homer Simpson grid operator. I'm just so curious. I mean, Homer's qualified for the nuclear power plants. I don't know if he can handle an entire grid, but I just think I'd love to learn more about it. I'm going to get here into the comments here shortly and start to get into that. But I just wanted to, again, just remind everybody that when you hear these stories, think critically and know that what happens normally in the news is there is some truth to the headlines. But then they kind of miss the point. They miss the bigger picture here. This is, yes, a challenge, but it's also an opportunity. If you're a battery manufacturer or you're a installer, you're an electrician, I mean, this is, we're looking at a transition that's going to be profitable for many people and companies. And it should be interesting. Now, one thing I did ask you guys to comment about is how you feel about nuclear power, which I know is contentious, and I know that everyone has a different opinion. The funny thing is, in our world where everything is kind of politically divided, and I think people on the left don't like nuclear anymore, people on the right do, which is a hard thing to make sense of. But I'm just kind of looking at how people feel about it. So okay, U-Haul mentions hydroelectric with dams. That is a great example of a really baseload power system because you could just control the flow of water and have very steady, predictable output. You've got big generators that you can spin up, keep, you know, with inertia. So hydroelectric is a luxury for everybody who has it. So the next Everything Electric show I'll be going to, fully charged Everything Electric, is in Vancouver. Now, BC Hydro, their power station there, their power provider, has like over 90% hydroelectric power, clean hydroelectric power from all the rains and snow runoff. It's an incredible luxury. So anybody who has hydroelectric power as an option, no-brainer. It is one of the most no-brainer forms of energy generation because it's really stable, predictable, and you can actually change the flow, right? You can't change the flow of wind and solar. So I'm a huge fan of that. Another question is hydrogen fuel cell. So that could work. That could work. It comes down to how you source your hydrogen. We made a video about a month ago on a hydrogen deposit that was discovered in France, which is interesting. Because if you have naturally occurring hydrogen, H2, like by itself, ready to use as a fuel, that's incredible. So if you could, like, for example, France, near where these deposits are, they could build power stations and not use them all the time, but whenever they're needed, kind of like a peaker power plant, right? Whenever the demand outpaces the supply, whenever there's a need to do it, you could quickly turn on a fuel cell, not maybe in minutes, not hours, right? And you could provide base load power with a fuel cell or even a hydrogen combustion engine that spins a turbine, kind of more like a natural gas system that does today. Yeah, there's challenges to both, but what it comes down to is the incredible inefficiency of producing hydrogen. So if you have a solar power plant, it might be, you know, the PV farm is 20% efficient. But after that, once you have electricity, you know, inverting is maybe a couple of percent, transmission is a couple of percent. It's well over 80% efficient. The problem is if you took that energy after it's produced from solar or wind and try to store it in hydrogen by producing green hydrogen, that process is really inefficient, probably around 40%. So that is the challenge, but I do think that could make sense as well. We need a combination of baseload and renewable sources, right? Baseload power plants are natural gas or nuclear, coal. We need a new solution for baseload. Hydrogen could potentially fill that void. Geothermal could do that, or hydroelectric, as we've mentioned. And then we've got to mix that in with renewables, add battery storage, and then we've got ourselves a clean grid that could actually work. These are challenges. They're not easy. They will cost money. But what's going to happen with natural gas prices and fossil fuels, gasoline, diesel prices are going to go up. They're not getting more abundant. So there's going to be a point where we should be investing before it's too late, which is kind of the thesis that Billy Bob Thornton has in Landman. If you haven't watched that show, most of my friends who told me to watch it thought I would hate it because they were talking a lot of smack about renewables. The opposite. I actually think it's a great show. There are some interesting things and there are a couple of mistakes or short-sighted views, but by and large, it's a great show. Highly recommend watching it. One of the points that he makes is the problem is what happens if we run out of oil and gas before we have an alternative in place? And that is something that we do not want to see because that would bring the entire global economy to a standstill, getting food at the grocery store, everything else. So this is it's an important point for sure. So so at this point, I think that is a kind of quick look at what happened and why these topics really matter and why we have to be out on the forefront of what's happening. Otherwise, you don't want to be caught with this happening again. One of our commenters mentioned what happened in Texas. There was a weatherization problem where Texas wasn't prepared for snow and cold weather that caused some of their power generation stations to come offline. We would be very ill prepared in California. If there was like a sudden freeze event, California would be in bad shape. We would have burst water lines and much, much more. It'd be bad. But areas like Boston and New York and Canada and, you know, the Scandinavian countries are well equipped for this. They know the weather is going to get cold, and so they're prepared. So really, it's kind of like the Boy Scouts, right? Just you got to be prepared. And I think what we really need is good leadership. That's the hard part, is there's a lot of moving parts. How do you get good leadership to invest in the right areas to make sure that we do have a certain level of investment happening and somebody who's got a vision for the future that includes some of these ideas that we've been talking about. All right, that's a quick look. At this point, we're going to switch gears and just chat with you guys and provide some updates and talk with the audience. Steve Park says Texas was a simple ripoff of its customers. Well, there's a lot of challenges with Texas because the ERCOT, their grid is not as connected to other grids as other areas. That I think that might be changing a little bit. One of the things that I think Texas is doing a good job of is they're actually installing more renewables than anybody. But in Texas, it's kind of a wild west. Electricity prices can swing. And if you have a battery, by the way, you could potentially make a lot of money if you join what's called like a virtual power plant program, where you can provide energy when it's needed and charge at times when there's too much. And there's a whole kind of stock trading marketplace kind of approach that is going to be really, really important. So Offberg says, batteries cannot do grid forming. They can do voltage and frequency support, but very poorly. Yeah, batteries cannot do grid forming. I mean, you've got to have a starting point, but batteries can do a pretty good job of providing a place for excess and filling in valleys when you don't have enough of supply. John Nodge says, I think every large PV array should have a good sized battery as part of the installation, which can provide power in those dips in solar output. Brilliant. I agree. We did a video about how Ivanpah is shutting its doors. That was that geo solar farm here in California that is, you know, going bankrupt. And what I was surprised is I just pulled up a Google map view of the area. And yes, that didn't work out. But as I started scrolling around, there are PV, you know, photovoltaic, just solar panels, solar panel farms popping up all over the place. And one of the most important ones that I saw does exactly that, where they're building batteries in conjunction with the solar to provide that double benefit. And I don't know if you regulate that or if you incentivize it. I'm not sure how to do that, but you're exactly right. That is how to do it. We got to bring the two things together. Micro Sangali says V2G cars, geothermal, and thorium. So that is a great combination. So V2G, vehicle to grid, is a technology that I think would be incredibly helpful as well. Imagine if you plugged in your car when you got home or in your garage or apartment complex, wherever the case might be, and you just leave it overnight or during the day when you're not using it, like you get to work, plug in, and you agree that you allow the grid to be able to pull from your pack when needed and put energy back into your pack. And you can set like a threshold, like I need 30 or 40 or 50% to be able to get home. So don't go under that. And then suddenly every battery, every car that's plugged in at work while you're working is a asset to the grid. So vehicle to grid is another one of those things. Now, the broad theme of a lot of this stuff is decentralization. Going away from power being generated in one place and shipped hundreds of miles to now everybody's got some micro solar, maybe some micro grids that are in DC and distributed energy as well. I met with a company who had a really cool concept in Texas, actually, in Austin. The company's in Austin, called Base Power, that they're a power utility company. And part of what they do for like a set fee is they will install batteries on your house. So what they're doing is they're doing distributed energy storage. Instead of having like a Tesla Megapack in one facility, which wouldn't help you if the grid went down, right? If the grid goes down, your house doesn't have power. But what Base Power is doing is building a decentralized network of, let's say, 30 to 50 kilowatt hours of energy at thousands of customer sites who could do the same thing, right? They could power the grid when needed, have a sink to store energy when it's not. And if the power were to go out, the grid were to go down, you still have a battery at your house. So I think that is genius. We live in an age where solar continues to make sense. I think for us in California, the prices are so high. Solar is a godsend. But now we live in an age where the battery really is going to be critical. If you're installing solar today, the battery's got to be on the forefront of your mind, especially as people are no longer giving you much in the way of credit for excess that you ship to the grid. And that's another topic for another day. Let me know, Sandhya, if you want me to do a video about that. I do have a video coming about how we were able to add to our system a couple of years after we got the original system and keep our net metering to status thanks to a battery and some clever engineering. So that video is coming soon. But to finish that concept off, geothermal is another one of those things. Geothermal's large challenge is locations, like the nature, the geology of the rock under our feet is variable. And so certain areas make a ton of sense. Others, it would be more difficult and costly. But we've got breakthroughs happening in terms of drilling. And so that's definitely a good option. And thorium in terms of nuclear fuel is another topic that I'm very interested in. So we can do videos about all that stuff. But that's a great comment. So Offberg says, is it possible to disaggregate the grid, make all homes have their own generation, but then homes will not be able to run workshops without small engines, and industrial power costs will go up around 30%. I think if we had, so, okay. The one of the things about technology, engineering, the future, thinking about things, being kind of a futurist, is there's certain things that have to happen for other things to happen. If batteries aren't, if they're not cheap, if we don't have a ton of companies like LG and Tesla and CATL and BYD, if we don't have a bunch of companies making batteries, they're never going to get cheap. If that doesn't happen, we don't have electric cars, right? It'd be a niche product for very rich people. Now we're at the stage where there is a lot of batteries. Now the sodium ion battery could completely upend even that, to the point where batteries just come in every house. It's like you have your hot water heater, you have your battery. It's just that common. That is not crazy to think about maybe 10 or 15 years from now. But if we, I think the answer really is what base power is doing, where we have batteries in homes. Instead of having a large, you know, 10 gigawatt hour battery plant somewhere that has the same problems, where if the grid goes down, if there's some fluctuation or some instability and the grid has to get cut, or a tree falls on your power line and you're on your street, you're still in a blackout, right? But if you have a battery in your home, then you always have power. We now have about 68 kilowatt hours of battery storage. And even through cloudy days, we just went through three cloudy days. We're not charging the cars. We're not heating the pool or anything else. Like, we go into a low power mode, but we can be off grid even through cloudy days now with our new solar system. And that's possible because of the batteries, right? Because the solar is a very small part of the day. That energy has to be stored somewhere. And I think the decentralized battery scheme is brilliant. And I think you're going to start seeing that pop up more. Subscribe and stay tuned. We will do a deep dive on this company, Base Power. I'm fascinated by what they're doing. I think they have about 1,000 customers so far, again, in Austin, Texas. And I'm really keen to learn more about them because it is really, really interesting. So U-Haul says, question, battery swapping stations instead of charging. That's fascinating. U-Haul, I don't know if you watched our video on CATL, but they actually are investing in everything and all the things. Like, they've got an entire battery pack that you can build out that has super, super fast charging. They have batteries that you can, you know, they have the swappable packs as well that they're building in conjunction with companies like NIO. But the battery swapping station concept is interesting because what you could do is you can have, in the case of what NIO is doing in their current charging packs, I think it was 21. They have 20 batteries inside that are charging that you can just, when the next person comes in, that battery's charged, slides in, goes into your car in about 3 to 4 minutes or so. I think it was about 3 minutes, 30 seconds is what we saw with the NIO swap when we were in Shanghai. And then the car's out, the next one comes in. So if you can keep these bay of batteries charged and topped off, then whenever somebody comes, you can serve them as quickly as you can make the switch. The cool thing is that means that those batteries are charging from the grid at a very consistent level. You have 20, 19, or 19 packs, whatever it is, and they're just charging at the same rate, kind of, right? By and large, that's a lot easier than having no need, and then somebody plugs in and pulls 250 kilowatts for a little while, and then for 5 minutes, and then stops. Those kinds of spikes are really, again, they're tough on the grid. So the battery swapping station could make sense, but we are entering an age where we're also seeing charging levels that are getting better and better. CATL also announced what they're calling their Shenzhen battery, which has a 12C charge rate. That means that my 100 kilowatt hour battery pack on my Tesla Model S could charge at like 1.2 megawatts of power. And obviously that's only for a peak period of time, but the average is over 6, which is still insane, right? 600 kilowatts of charging speed average. Now that we don't even have stations that quick yet, but the batteries are not going to be the limitation for much longer. The grid probably will be at that point, especially as there's more EVs on the road. So Peter Birdsall says, dependent people fail, independent people win. That's a philosophy I've definitely had. I don't know what my utility company is doing, and I don't really much care. My goal since I graduated from university has always been to have a house that was like completely self-reliant. Now, we're not water reliant. We're very much reliant on our utility, our water utility to provide water for our house until we like dig a well and find out, you know, that's something that we're reliant on. But when it comes to electricity, we really don't need our grid. We could go potentially, depending on the time of year and how careful we are, we could go weeks or months probably without the grid, which is pretty amazing. And I agree, that's a powerful feeling. Let's see. Offberg says, in a clean energy world, there will be no swimming pools. I disagree. I have zero electric bills. I heat my pool with a heat pump pool heater on sunny days when I have excess, and I have a pool and I wouldn't give it up. This is one thing I never have agreed with. I don't agree with this, you know, we should all be living in tiny little pods and using no energy. No, I don't believe in that. I want to have a pool. I want to be able to swim when I need to, when I want to. I want my kids to have nice birthday parties and do it all sustainably. And we've kind of come across a way to do that. Pool heat pumps. We have a video on that as well. It has been brilliant. Our pool is 72 degrees right now, which is not common for San Diego. An unheated pool is probably in the like maybe 60. And the difference between that is pretty staggering. And we're entering summer, so the pool is going to be north of 80 here. So Offberg said you should make your own water. Now, my pool heat pump actually does produce water. What we'll do is we run it in the early morning when the dew point is a lot closer, and we have a gray water capture tank that it feeds into. So if you were to look at it, you'll see a nice little steady stream of water that it's producing, which we use to water the grass and our plants and our palm trees and stuff. So it's not enough, right? We need hundreds of gallons a day. We're not producing hundreds of gallons a day, but it's a fun side effect. So Zach Kane says, definitely would love to start a microgrid company, Freedom Power. I'm with you. I think it's really, really interesting. And I think we're starting to see the benefits of some of this stuff. Maybe in the future, our power plant companies are almost like not an afterthought. They're a extra padding when we can't produce enough of our own. But I think to build a home today and have no solar on your roof and to be completely reliant on the grid, to me, just seems backward. Like, why would you want to be beholden to some company who can jack up your rate and play these games? I've always, TW says, DaVinci wants to blame me and I refuse. I didn't put Big Macs in styrofoam. I didn't produce things in plastic versus glass. The best we have is to try and fix it. I don't know what you think I'm blaming you for. See, the sun's big geomagnetic hole is right. I'm not sure what you're... I'm not blaming anybody. I don't like to blame anyone for anything, including the utilities or anybody else. If I could do something for myself, I like to do that. So that's something that we all can do. We can all take our own responsibilities. We're actually growing our own food now. This is a new development. There's a part of our house that was just always a mess that we've wanted to grow our own crops. So now we have a lot of leafy greens that we can go out, snip, put them in a plate and make a little salad, which is pretty cool. So we're just trying to, you know, kind of some old school joy, just a little simple joys in life. So I'm not blaming anybody. I just want to make that clear. I'm not sure where that comment was headed, but definitely not. So yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to approach when we're doing change. One is to be kind of I don't know if you guys see those climate people, Stop Oil Now. They're ruining beautiful paintings and making a mess of it all. They're accomplishing nothing. You're just making people that aren't ready to stop burning oil hate you and your cause even more. It accomplishes nothing. If you want to be a part of the solution, go join a company that's making a new battery or some new solution to the problem, right? A software platform that is energy trading to help bring stability, or a supercapacitor company or something like that. Like, we have to think about the future with optimism, because every challenge that we have is a potential place for us to be providing new solutions, right? It's kind of the optimist is always, it's always a solution. So I hope that so really quick, I wanted to kind of give you guys a little bit of an update too. We have had some crazy travels. We had a trip to Taiwan, Shanghai, and Tokyo, and we made videos with CATL and a couple other places. And so we're back now. We have a video coming out this week on Microsoft's Majorana 1 quantum computer, which is really, really fascinating. And we had a chance to interview one of their chief PhDs that is working on this stuff. It was a really cool conversation. We'll probably have a whole podcast as well. And then the week after that, we have a really cool episode on Challenger. How many of you guys remember Challenger and the Challenger disaster? It was one of the space shuttles that crashed about a little over a minute after takeoff. But the story behind it is fascinating. I learned about it when I was doing aircraft mishap response work for the U.S. Navy back in my first career, and that story has stuck with me, and it's a story I've been wanting to tell. So we get a chance to do it. So Zach says, "Are you going to get a chance to see the Tello truck?" Well, can you make a note of that? I'm not familiar with that. I love the Slate truck, and we'll check it out and see if there's something we could get access to. Steve Park says supercaps are a great idea for EV charging. It'd be perfect for long haul travel recharge. Yeah, that's a really good point. Supercapacitors have a lot of really cool benefits. Like, for one, it's not a chemical reaction, so there's no, dendrites that form. A supercapacitor could work for 100,000 cycles with no degradation, which is really cool. And it can charge and discharge really, really quickly. So this is Teletrek. Oh wow, that's cool. No way. That's cool. Really? Okay. The challenge with a lot of these ideas is manufacturing. But if they made that thing, would you want one? Yes. Sign me up. Kind of the same for Slate. Which actually gets me into another thing. Everything's connected, right? When I was in Taiwan, I met a little bit and had a chat with somebody from Foxconn. So Foxconn is the company that makes the iPhone, the iPad, the Nintendo Switch, the Amazon Kindle. They're a manufacturing company. They're the largest electronics manufacturing company, and they're the company that companies like Apple and Microsoft reach out to when they need to get something made. They have all the expertise, and they're really good at it. And now they have a new line called Foxtron, and they're trying to get into manufacturing EVs. So my advice, if you have a cool EV startup concept and you're trying to get it off the ground, I mean, it's hard enough to build a car, and then you have to go invest $2 billion in a factory. It is crippling. And that's why we've seen a lot of startups fail. So I would say your first model, maybe your first two models. What's the harm in having Foxtron? Like, have Foxtron or Magna or one of these contract manufacturing companies do the work and get to market. Start building your customer base, and then when you start floating money and you're profitable, then you can talk about building your own factory and building your own EV. But I really think that might be the way for all EV startups going forward. Because I mean, Lucid has survived, but I mean, it's been a really tough battle for Lucid, and they've spent billions and they have deep backing. Rivian also is kind of a darling. They've had good backing and they're turning it around, and Tesla. But then everybody else has been going bankrupt. One of the ones that really made me sad was, Juan, what was the Walmart truck? What was that? Canoe. I really liked the canoe. There was this canoe van that was actually shorter and smaller than I think it was a BMW 3 Series. But on the inside, you could see eight people or a ton of cargo. It was an incredible thing. I loved this thing, but sadly not to be. We'll do a video. I've been trying to reach out to see if I can get some access with Foxconn, or like Magna, one of these kinds of manufacturing companies, because I want to get that message out there. Like, if you have a startup idea, I'm not sure where Tello is. We'll do some research. We'll figure that out. Slate, similarly. The best thing you could probably do is get to market and do it with a company that knows what they're doing. Wolfgang says K cars rule. We were just in Tokyo, saw a bunch of them. They do freaking rule. It's a shame that that form factor is just not popular in the US. U-Haul says Japan flourished with the Toyota Prius, hasn't embraced EVs. That is very true. Although I will say Honda, right, Juan, there was probably two or three, four models that Honda had in Shanghai that were pretty awesome. So these are cars that they're not selling here in the US, but they do have in Shanghai. Maybe they're using, like Chinese technology, Chinese battery packs and stuff. And the Chinese EV market is insane. Most of the cars are electric. And I was blown away being in Shanghai, just how much of the traffic was electric. So the most impactful part is as you're walking around the streets in Shanghai, it's quiet. It's a bustling city of over 20 million, 25 million people, but it was whisper quiet. And yes, the cars are largely electric. It was kind of rare to see a gasoline car. But the real impactful thing, especially in Asia, all the scooters in Shanghai are electric, all of them. There are no gas scooters. And that was such a difference compared to like India, for example. In India, it's just a ruckus. Being out on the street, you'll get a headache from the fumes and the noise. It's just a very unpleasant experience. And Shanghai was like quieter than any city I've ever been to. It was insane. It was truly, that was probably my biggest takeaway from being there. So we'll see. So Zach says the CTO of Tesla is Forrest North. He was with Tesla in the early days. Zach, on our list, we'll definitely reach out and see if we could do something. Because I mean, and from what I saw really quickly, that's the sort of truck that we need, and I hope we do it. So let's see. TW says, okay, I'm just trying to look through if there's any other comments and stuff. Compact trucks, yeah. I think the Maverick, the Ford Maverick, should show us people will buy a very affordable car. We've kind of lost our minds with the average price of cars. There are, when I was a kid, my first car had roll-up windows. You had to reach over and flip the door lock. There was none of it. It was a cheap, my first car was an Acura Integra, a 1992, about 8 years old when I bought it. And I loved it to pieces. It was one of my favorite cars. And it was a manual transmission, four cylinder, pretty reliable, a great car. But we've since, everything is luxurious and sound. We don't need that. The Slate truck, the Slate EV, the pickup truck, I think is going to really, Tello is another example, potentially, hopefully reset what we're looking for. It's the feature creep has been out of control in cars. And as a result, the new cars are selling for on average like 45 grand, which is insane. That's 20 grand, 15 to 20 grand was the average when I was growing up. And now we're talking about 45. It's just insane. And I know that incomes and stuff haven't kept pace, so we do need some options like that. Aptera. So Zach also mentioned Aptera, two car solution, Aptera and the Tello MT1. That would be cool. We have a reservation for an Aptera. They're a San Diego, Southern California company. We wish them well. We haven't touched base with them in a little while. Maybe we'll do a follow-up video, but they're getting close to manufacturing from what I hear. So Steve Park says downtown Denver has a lot of electric scooters, seems to be doing well for getting around town. Agreed. An electric scooter, especially because you're not going over 45-ish miles an hour, and at those lower speeds, the range is really good. You don't need to have a huge battery pack. And by the way, in Shanghai, they even have scooter battery pack swapping station. It's not even a station. You just pull the battery out and you go to a locker, put a combo, pull a battery out, pay, tap to pay, grab the new battery, put it in your scooter and ride away. And so there's this like Amazon locker style place where there's just a bunch of scooter batteries charging. So they've standardized that too. Standardization is going to be an important part, right? When we talk about why these things can happen, we have to standardize things. Like all cars have to have the same plug. In North America now, it's NACS. It's really important that we have standards to make some of this stuff possible. But it is really, really fascinating. I kind of want to buy a little electric scooter or motorcycle, something just to zip around town. But like I've mentioned, we actually charge our cars purely on sunshine now. So on sunny days when there's enough sun, we charge the cars. Now we had three cloudy days in a row, so the range of the cars just kept going lower and lower. But if you have a 200 or 300 mile range EV, Easy. So we now, with our solar and our batteries, we run our house, our business, and we use a lot of energy, like 100 kilowatt hours a day, and our two EVs. So all of our driving, all of our living, our work, business, everything is completely run by sunshine, which is, to me, that's just cool, right? And it's thanks to batteries. All right, with that, I think we're going to wrap this up. Really want to thank all of you guys for taking time. We're going to try to do this a little bit more often. I do have other trips coming up and stuff, but whenever we're home, we're going to try to do more live shows. I want to do a video about my thoughts on China. I was there for 3 days. Have some thoughts about it for sure. Maybe that'll be a future follow-up. But whenever there's stories like this, reach out to us. Join our Discord. We have a bunch of links, by the way. Our website, you can become a member, support the show directly. We're going to start building some courses. We have a really cool solar course. I want it to be the best guide to solar and batteries for your home on the internet. And so that'll be coming out soon as well. And we have links to our Discord. You can join and you could just pitch ideas. We have a lot of our viewers that are on our Discord who, and this particular video about Spain, I heard from one of our viewers. I was on travel at the time, so I couldn't make the episode until now, but please do join. We appreciate you guys. You guys will make this possible. That's never lost on me. Have a great Friday and have a great weekend. And we'll catch you guys on the next one.